My name's Kate Rolls, and I'm interviewing you for the Wellcome Trust, as you're taking part in Anthony Gormley's new artwork, One and Other. The date today is the 1st of August 2009, and if I can please ask you to state your full name, your date of birth, and where you come from.
I'm Father Ed Hone. I was born on the 2nd of June 1959. I'm born in Yorkshire, and I've come down from Edinburgh, where I'm a priest in the centre of the city.
Fantastic. In which church are you a priest?
St Patrick's Church, just off the Royal Mile.
Right, okay, lovely. We can maybe come back to that in a while. First of all, if I can ask you, when you first heard about this project, what it was that made you decide to apply?
I've always been an admirer of Anthony Gormley's work, and the focus on the human form and the simplicity of it, but the way in which the sculpture interacts with the environment and people interact with the sculpture, from the Angel of the North to Blind Light to the work on Crosby Beach, all of them that I've seen, just been fascinated by. And when I saw this event on the fourth plinth, One and Other coming up, I thought that is something I would love to do. I didn't even hesitate, and I kind of knew when I applied that I'd get on it. I don't know how, but I just think it's just a great celebration of the human person and of a cross section of this society at this time.
Yeah, fantastic. And when you found out that you had got a place, how did you decide how to use your hour?
Well, I'm a priest, and you know, a lot of the work I do is very serious, but my parish also has done a lot of events over the years in the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and so I thought, well, I could go kind of in an arty direction, or I could go in a religious direction, and I had to think about it for a while, but after a bit of thought, I thought, well, this is a celebration of people and a celebration of society belonging to each other, and I thought, I'll do what priests do. I'll pray for people, and I'll invite people to send their prayers in to me by email or in any other way, and I'll pray for those intentions on the plinth. I'll also say hello to family and friends and things like that. I'm also I've been working 4 years with my colleagues in Edinburgh to have a local lady declared a saint. She's now Venerable Margaret Sinclair, born in 1900, died in 1925. A very ordinary woman, but a very holy woman, and an inspiration and help to a lot of people. And I think it'd just be great if she was declared a saint. So that's another thing I'm going to be praying for from the plinth.
Mm. Are you going to be preaching in any way?
No. We're preached at in all kinds of ways all the time, even in ways we're not aware, through advertising and political and religious indoctrination and everything. I've produced a leaflet just called Priest on the Plinth, explaining what I'm doing, but it's not trying to push people to believe, for example, or to make them think in a certain way. It's just to explain what's going on. Yeah.
And you have your rosary beads with you, I see.
That's right. It's part of my religious habit. I'm wearing my religious habit. I'm a redemptorist, which means I belong to a worldwide religious order that preaches and travels around, and so I thought, well, it's a visible sign, you know, of my belonging to the order and being part of the church and belonging to a community, and the beads are part of that habit, and so I'll just be praying a simple prayer on every bead, just quietly. It's an easy prayer to do when there's lots of distractions around, and Trafalgar Square isn't the most contemplative place in the world, but I think the plinth will also be a good place to pray as well.
When did you become a priest?
1988. I trained for 6 or 7 years and then was ordained in 88 in London, in Clapham.
Clapham?
Yeah.
At which particular church?
St Mary's, Clapham Common.
Okay.
And it's one of the early Roman Catholic churches when Clapham was just a village outside London. It was the first Roman Catholic church south of the river. And it's a great place, great centre of prayer and devotion, and a very, very multinational and wonderful history and wonderful celebration of culture. I'm very fond of the church and the people there. Mm. Yeah.
That must have been an amazing day for you to be when you became a priest. Can you Can you take me there a little bit? Could you tell me a bit about how it was to become a priest?
It's, I mean, the way that the Catholic Church approaches ministry is the priest is this person that's a bit apart, you know, we're not allowed to get married, and it's a long training, and it's for life, you know, you don't resign, you're not supposed to retire, and all this kind of stuff. And so it's a big decision to become a priest, and I went through with it, and because I joined a religious order, it's all done in community. I was a novice for a year in Plymouth. I was a student in Canterbury, where I did a master's degree. And then I was in service training in Liverpool, and then I was ordained in London. The actual day was just wonderful, just a great celebration of faith and family and friends and parishioners, and it was just great. But there is a kind of irony in this, because I've always said that one of the problems in the Catholic Church is people place the priest on a pedestal and set him apart. And of course, I've got to eat my words now, because I'm putting myself on one, a very big one and a public one. But because, you know, my point being that priests are just human beings, and when we forget that we are, you know, all kinds of things go wrong, and the whole kind of job becomes dysfunctional and everything. And we're human beings with a particular calling. You know, it doesn't take away our humanity and vulnerability and everything. But I think I can be excused this pedestal this once.
And how were your family, when you told them you wanted to become a priest, how did they react?
I grew up in a Catholic family, a religious family. Not oppressively so, but happily religious. And so my mum and dad were delighted. One of my sisters did point out that I might not be able to get married and have children. I said I had actually thought about that. Generally, if they thought it was going to make me happy, they were happy with it. And that's the way they've been all along. And even in the moments of doubt and kind of, you know, when you stand back and review everything, they've said it's about your happiness. And so they're supportive all the way along. Yeah.
Can I ask you about being a priest as a vocation? Do you you feel that it's a vocation for you?
It is. I didn't kind of hear a voice from heaven, you know, calling me in that particular way. But in the same way as you enter a relationship or you choose a career path, there are things prompting you, some things you understand and some things you don't. Some of it's kind of subconscious. And the feeling that I'd always been religious, not just in the Catholic sense, but in the wider sense of thinking there's more to life than just what we can see and touch and feel and taste and everything. And that there is a genuine spiritual dimension to life and to my life. And often we approach it in different ways and name it in different ways. But I just felt that I wanted to be in that part of life. And I've always felt incredibly loved by my family, and I've had wonderful friendships as well. And I can't separate that from feeling that God loves me immensely. And maybe if I'd had a different childhood experience, different life experience, I might think God was cold and distant. I don't know. But that's the way I find it. So I find it easy to believe God loves people and God loves me. And being a priest is a response to that. It's just saying, you know, knowing I'm ultimately affirmed, what can I do in the lives of people that don't feel valued, or people struggling against the odds in one way or another, or people looking for direction, or, as I said before, it's not for me to give them dogma or to hector them into belief or something, but to support them in growth, spiritual growth, in finding personal and social freedom, live justly, and all that. You know, it's all tied in together. And for me, it comes out as being a Catholic religious priest, as a redemptorist. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about your upbringing, your background?
Fairly ordinary upbringing. Mum and dad, three sisters. Mum and dad were in catering. Dad was a waiter, mum was a waitress. And he was a head waiter, so he put her on the same duties as himself until he managed to ask her out. Then eventually they got their own business, a restaurant, and we all worked in that as kids and growing up. And very ordinary family, struggling to make ends meet at times. And my mum's family, Irish, so we always had this kind of half the family in Ireland and half in England, where my dad's family are. Very close to our cousins and relations. And all my sisters are married and have families, and that's really good, and we all keep in touch. Mum and dad now live in Ireland. I went to university simply because I got swept along in a tide, because none of my family had ever been before, and I just found that amazing and eye-opening and thrilling. And I'm just on the point of going back to the same university to do a doctorate, so I've got study leave, so I can't wait for that either.
What's your doctorate going to be?
It's in the area of, it's a doctorate in theology and ministry. So it's like practical theology, and it's all about preaching. What's the message of preaching? I could get very technical about it, but traditionally preaching is about telling people they've got to have their sins forgiven. But we've got lots of different understandings now of what saving someone means. You know, are we saving the planet, or saving ourselves through therapy, or through consumption, or are we saving the world politically? And I'm interested in how this is dealt with in Christian preaching, and of course in my own kind of preaching as well. So it's got a practical focus, and it's an area that interests me and has done.
And what first degree in?
My first degree, I did a year general arts at Durham University, and I loved English and I loved the history and I loved the classics, but I wanted to have more of a focus, and I couldn't do any of those three because I didn't have Latin. The only arts degree I could do was theology, and they taught you Greek to learn the New Testament. So purely by accident really, I switched to theology. And kind of stuck with it. So that was, I did theology at Durham, and then did divorce and remarriage at Canterbury, and preaching at Durham again, if the brain's not too rusty. I'm 50 this year, so one and other is a kind of a midlife thing as well, I suppose. You know, it's just a nice marker.
Yeah.
Mm.
And in the time between going to university and becoming a priest, what did you do for a profession?
I didn't really. I went straight from university, had a summer holiday, and then became a novice. It was kind of quite dramatic really, because I went to Ireland on a family holiday, and then for the week I was going to Plymouth, my mum and dad hired a motorhome, motor caravan. Myself, my sister, her boyfriend, my younger sister, mum and dad drove around Cornwall, and I went swimming on a beach with my sister and the boyfriend. And we got swept out to sea in dangerous tides, and we had to be rescued. And this was 2 days before I was due to leave the world as a novice. You know, it's a year when you cut off, and it was very dramatic and very frightening. That's how I remember it. I nearly didn't get there at all. But that year was a great year. Devon and Cornwall were very beautiful, and I was swept up in the whole romantic notion, you know, of living in a monastery and living a rule of life and regular prayers, and I'm not always that regular now, but...
And that was what you did, was that you did live in a monastery?
Yeah.
Could you describe that, how that is to live in a monastery for most people who wouldn't ever experience that?
It's like a family. You're living with people you would never have chosen to live with, so you've got to get on. And more than that, you're supposed to be living a kind of idealistic life. So when you annoy each other, you're supposed to forgive each other, and you share the duties, the practical duties, you know. We had to cook for ourselves, clean for ourselves, do our washing and the garden and everything like that. The monastery was a breeze block monastery built in the 1930s on a housing estate. Well, a housing estate sprang up around it subsequently. So it wasn't a kind of romantic place in the country. And you meet every morning at 7:30 for morning prayer and meditation. That lasts half an hour. Then you've midday prayer, you've prayer before meals, evening prayer, you've mass, which is the main service of the day. And then your duties, you're reading, and when you're training, you don't have much in the way of preaching or visiting people or that kind of thing. But later on, when you're, you know, living as a fully best priest or brother, when you've taken your vows, your three vows for life, and when you're ordained, if you're ordained, you've also an outside focus, because we're not monks. Monks enter a monastery to leave the world, as it were. We live in community, so we can go out from the community. So it's, in a way, it's the biggest blessing and the most annoying thing ever. My last community has been a fairly small one, three or four of us, and you just love it when the others go away and you have the house to yourself for a day or a couple of days. But it's kind of rich life. It's not for everyone. And as I say, sometimes it's great, and sometimes it's, I can only say, awful.
And today you're going to be standing on the plinth. What does that mean to you personally?
I'm, I suppose, naturally kind of quite extrovert, but strangely enough, when it comes to my religion and, you know, I'm happy to say I'm a priest, or, but I don't normally go around dressed in my collar or in my religious habit. I'm not that kind of a priest, and I do feel confident about my belief. It's not to say I don't have doubts, you know, I do, but I don't feel I need to prove to anyone. But this is a way of just saying, this is me as a person. This is what I do in my life. This is part of my vision for the world, that we support each other, that we're interconnected, that the life of someone on the other side of the world can matter to me, and I can make a difference to that life. And the church, and, well, all churches and all religions can get bad presses as well as good presses. And I suspect they're all equally flawed and equally gifted, depending which side of them's to the fore at any given time. And I'm saying, well, this is a side of the church of which I'm immensely proud, this representation to connectedness, that we are linked spiritually, that we have a God who loves us, and we're a family, we're one human family because of that. So me being on the plinth is just saying, this is who I am, what I believe, what I think we can do for each other and for our world. And it's just a moment of joy, really. That's what it means.
Yeah. Mm. And as you said, you don't always wear your habits.
Yeah, yeah.
During your everyday life. When you're not dressed as a priest and you're kind of being yourself,
yeah,
not being a priest, how do you engage with the world in terms of your personal hobbies and interests and the avenues?
Yeah, I enjoy socialising,
yeah,
and I have a great kind of network of friends, and it spills over into parishioners. So sometimes people start being parishioners and, you know, we become friends. And I enjoy walking, cycling, reading, films, theatre, life, really. And for me, not wearing the collar or the habit isn't a kind of a, that I don't believe in them, but they allow people to pigeonhole you and place you in a role, and they change the way they speak to you, and invariably they'll start a conversation with, well, I'm not religious myself, but, or they presume that there's only one aspect to your life and that they have to talk to you about that and to feed you this stuff. And I'm not interested. I might be interested in the person. And if they want to bring up faith or belief or religious practice or whatever as part of who they are, fine. But not because they're obliged to talk to me about it because I'm a priest. So I want to get to know the person first, the person to get to know me. And then if that's part of what crops up, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And if other guys want to wear their habits and collars, fine.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I do, like today.
Yeah.
But traditionally in England, certainly for hundreds of years, Roman Catholics didn't wear the religious habits, you know, because of historical cultural reasons. So it's not often that even though that we'd wear one in complete public, usually in church or something like that. Yeah.
And how are you finding, you've been doing the job for a number of years now, how are you finding it? Has it changed at all over the years, the way that you practice, I suppose, as you get more experience?
Yeah, there's a number of factors that influence it. What things that are going on in the church. So it was really interesting during the time of John Paul II, for example, watching his influence on Eastern Europe and the rise of solidarity and the coming down of the Iron Curtain and the church playing a role in that. I have colleagues in Ukraine, in Slovakia, Croatia, in all the former, in Russia, in Siberia, in all the former USSR countries, and seeing the role the church has played in bringing them, if you like, into line with the West and into communication. And that's changed the way the church has related to the world. Someone now said Europe is now breathing on two lungs. Then the character of the present Pope and the things they put on the agenda. Then the awful things like the sex abuse scandals that have been brewing for a long time and have suddenly, and in one way that's awful, I don't mean to be trite by this, but chickens coming home to roost, a church that managed things through power rather than service, again, flawed human beings doing what flawed human beings do. So that's affected what it's like to be a priest and to minister, and the fact I've got goodness knows how many certificates to say I can work with children and vulnerable adults. And it's such a shame. It's necessary, but it's a shame. It's taken some kind of level of innocence away and freedom. But that's the price we pay for tolerating and allowing abuse of any kind. So there's also kind of more freedom. People are less institutional in their approach to life. There's less automatic respect for institution, for uniform, for organisation, for officialdom, and that's true of the church, of politics, of forces of law and order, and we're feeling the effect of that. One part of the church is I don't mean this as a criticism, but is retreating into more uniforms, more order, the way things used to be, and the other part, I suppose a more liberal end of the church, is trying to cope with it by being part of this melting pot of a modern secular society. You know, we're trying to relate each in our own way. So as society's changed, as the church changes, what being a priest means changes. Mm.
Is that something that you notice from church to church, that there's different ways of being a priest in terms of the how conventional the practice is? Is that something that is in the priest community that you're kind of, that is sort of charted?
Well,
in a way,
there are really interesting things going on at the moment. For about 30 or 40 years we had what was called the ecumenical movement, where Catholics were supposed to talk to Protestants and get to know each other and put behind us years of division and misunderstanding and all that. And it was like that was an end in itself, you know, that we had to get to know each other and like each other, and that was good. But it's all moved on from that now, and they're calling the phenomenon the emerging church. And this isn't something that's organised or something that you're encouraged to do. But what it is, it appears, is a way of networking where you find your allies or your co-workers, your peers, on areas of common interest, not on areas of denomination. So, for example, if I'm campaigning against Trident nuclear missiles or against the death penalty or for justice somewhere or whatever, then I wouldn't automatically always work through the Catholic agencies. I say, oh, the Quakers are doing great things in that field, and I know so-and-so, and the Church of England has a really good body. And this feeling that you don't have to prove your loyalty to your own denomination, mixing with Anglicans and Methodists and Baptists and Church of Scotland isn't going to threaten or change my allegiance, but can enrich how I minister as a priest and how we are as a congregation, because we're pooling what we genuinely share in common and what drives us. And there's a lot of that going on in areas of, well, all kinds of areas, social justice, response to the financial crisis, life issues, even worship. And that's something that really I find very exciting at the moment. And it's just beginning, really.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that happen in an organised way, that different religions come together to discuss these sort of actions that can be taken?
Well, 20 years ago, I'd have got an invitation from some Catholic nuns to do something in a parish or a Catholic church in another part of the country to do this, or a Catholic school to give a talk, or some non-Catholic institution or person doing the ecumenical thing, deliberately approaching me because I was a Catholic. Now it might be any other church or an interfaith body, simply because they think I've got interesting things to say on a certain subject, and I also happen to be Roman Catholic. So it's kind of not organised in that way, but it's some kind of thing that's happening across the board, that we're being driven by areas of common interest and what is an effective way to approach the subject I'm dealing with. And I dare say it's got as many banana skins strewn along that path, I don't know, but I just find it quite interesting to observe it as a phenomenon, and I wasn't aware of it as such when I was ordained 21 years ago. Possibilities it opens up are great, so I'm just as likely to be speaking at an interfaith group or preaching in a Church of Scotland, or we had a St Patrick's Day parade in Edinburgh led by a 24-piece pipe band, and were waved off by the minister of the Church of Scotland Cathedral wearing a green tie, and other churches were involved, not in a trying to be PC, but just this was a celebration that people wanted to be part of. So that was good.
Have you ever been to the Vatican?
Of course I have.
Have you gone, I'm not sure how it works with sort of European conventions of priests.
Yeah.
Does that happen when you get invited?
There's different levels. We have our own headquarters of my order in Rome, and so if I go to Rome, I'd stay with them. It's between St Mary Major's and John Lateran. And most orders have their headquarters in Rome. Then there's the, obviously, St Peter's and the Vatican Palace, where the Pope lives most of the year. Then there's all the bureaucracy, the curial offices. Now, it's not often you'd get behind the scenes there. Our Archbishop in Edinburgh was made a cardinal 5 or 6 years ago, and quite a few of us went out from Edinburgh, and we did get behind a lot of scenes there, and that was great fun, and kind of quite impressive. But the press love this thing about secret Vatican archives and everything. We've discovered things in Edinburgh, like a film that nobody's seen for 40 years about Margaret Sinclair, and so we advertise this, and then the press pick up film found in secret Vatican archives, whereas it was just in a cupboard in the parish house. So there's a lot of mystique. Dan Brown has helped fuel, but I mean, it's such a splendid place and such a historical place that it's bound to kind of feature in Catholic and wider Christian life.
And did you meet the Pope personally?
No, never. I mean, from a distance.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
The kind of popularity cult, I think, can also, this thing about putting people on pedestals when they're human, it's great to have a figurehead, and a figurehead can be a symbol of unity and authority and everything, but if that slips over too far into, you know, celebrity culture, and I think popes are very aware of that, so it doesn't actually bother me. Besides, they might tell me off for not wearing my collar or the habit.
Can I ask you about your own ambitions in a way for life? It's a very general question, but what is it that you maybe if we look at the priesthood, is there something in particular that you would like to change, or if you have any sort of priorities with your, within your role in the, that you, for your own future within it?
Yeah, I don't have definite aims in the sense that, you know, in 5 years' time I'd like to do so and so. But anything that is life-giving to people and that that helps people, I mean, life can be so awful and grind people down in such a way. I have colleagues in Zimbabwe, and I've been out there 3 times, and just seen the grinding poverty and the sheer hell of life. And yet, in spite of that, people's resilience and people's determination to get on, even in the face of oppression and injustice. So anything that, that is life-giving and anything that frees people from whatever is holding them back, whether it is social injustice or personal misery or whatever. So my ambitions, you know, I want to be happy and free myself, but I also want to share that with other people. And so I'll just follow whatever does that. Mm-hmm. And prayer is a part of that, and worship is a part of that, because the prophet said, if the people have no vision, they perish. If we've no dreams to dream, we've no life to live. You know, we've just existed to trudge through. And so if I can keep a vision of heaven before me, whether it's literally true or not, I don't know, but if I can keep that vision there, then I've something to orientate myself by and something to aim for and something to walk towards in the company of others.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kate. That's great. Thank you. Mm.